My name is Dario Hasenstab, and I'm here with Balder Hagrids, and we're back with the Western Bubble podcast. Balder, greetings to you and greetings to our listeners from the center of power of the world today, as I believe Joe Biden, Emmanuel Macron, Keir Starmer, and Olaf Scholz are all here in Berlin with me, not with me, and talking about very important things, making me very important.
Hi, Dario. Well, greetings from the center of tapas and sunshine here in Madrid. You just told me this before we recorded, and I had absolutely no clue that that was happening. That's also telling, right? That I, someone who works on international relations every day, didn't even know that this summit was happening right now in your hometown.
I only know about it because they blocked all of public transportation. Because I assume Biden is taking the train from the airport to the city center, which is why they would block the trains. I don't know, jokes aside, he's getting a prize, and I think he's on his farewell tour. You know, like all those old bands, I don't know, the Scorpions, who've apparently been doing this for centuries now, that they're always going for one last goodbye tour. I think this is Biden's goodbye tour.
Oh, yeah, and Scorpions were basically one-hit wonders, right? So are you calling Biden a one-hit wonder as well there? Is that the analogy?
Yes.
But a prize, because we briefly mentioned this, but a prize for what exactly?
So he's getting the highest basically honor you can receive in Germany. It's a bit tricky because this one is reserved for heads of states from other countries. So it's a really big deal, of course. Only George W. Bush Sr., or I think the W without it, right? I think it's just George Bush Sr. He got that prize before for all his contributions to German unity, basically not being against it. And Biden is now receiving a prize for his contributions to the transatlantic relations, because the moment he became elected, they were revitalized and Europe was no longer worried about Trump basically ending NATO tomorrow. So we are giving a prize.
Are we also giving a prize to Putin? Because thanks to Putin, NATO is really close together now. Yeah? So really, I would argue that Vladimir has a bigger impact than Joe in this sense.
Definitely. But I don't think we could. I don't think it's something we could necessarily sell in Germany. But it is interesting, right, that you have, obviously, right, they do this in the context of war as well, saying that, you did so much to unify the West because of the war in Ukraine and also the war in the Middle East. And thank you very much. And today we're going to talk about these topics together.
We live in strange times. And I also think it's telling that the Germans decide to give the prize to George H. Bush and Joe Biden, out of all the choices that they had available to them, right?
They had many other choices. But so I already mentioned the Middle East, and kind of let's move into the more serious aspect of this episode, because one of the biggest things that happened this week actually happened yesterday, when the military leader of Hamas, Yahya Sinwar, was kind of confirmed to have been killed by the Israeli Defense Forces. This happened yesterday, and there's a few different aspects to it. And the first one I want to talk about with you is how we learned about this. It's because obviously the news broke it. Oh, we're thinking that he might be dead. We're still confirming it. But the moment that these news articles were out, images of basically the corpse of Sinwar were already going viral. And we're living in an interesting time of war, where basically someone gets killed and the first instinct of the killer is, let me take a picture. And then the first instinct of his superior is, let me leak this picture to social media so that people can look at it all over the world.
Yeah, and it's extremely uncomfortable. There was also this drone video that's been doing the rounds of just before he got killed. And I don't know, I don't think that this is having the propaganda impact that Israel thinks it does, right? It also, for me, it's probably once again a sign of Israel not really being in tune, well, or not at all being in tune with the global vibes, right? Because in many ways, I think people are not impressed by this. Yes, this is a big name. I mean, leaders have been killed all over the place. This every other week there is a big, either from Hezbollah or a Hamas leader being killed. This, of course, is a particularly important one. But I think that the global community is not particularly interested anymore, and Israel doesn't seem to be reading the room in that sense.
I kind of remember this. Remember when Osama bin Laden got killed by SEAL Team 6 by the United States in Pakistan? I think it was in 2011. And then afterwards, kind of accounts went public of how the killing went down. And he was basically there with his family, you know, and they were his children, also younger sons were kind of in the room before. And then he was standing there and the soldier then described how he was standing in front of Osama bin Laden and he then shoots him. In that moment, it always makes them somewhat human, right? Because these are people who have an aura created around them of Osama bin Laden, the worst terrorist the world has ever seen. Sinwar, I think we can also, I mean, he's the mastermind, right, behind the October 7th attacks. So they always have this aura around them. And when we talk about them while they're still alive, it's kind of talking about a name and a concept. But then the moment that they're dead, we're talking about a dead person, a dead human. And this also kind of happened with this video where you see someone who is dying and a drone is filming him and he's trying to, I mean, for the ones who haven't seen the video, we're obviously going to link it in the post description, but Sinwar is then throwing a plank of wood at the drone that's filming him. And that's kind of the last living proof you see of him.
And interestingly enough, that watching that video, and I got very uncomfortable feelings, but not in the sense that, I don't think there's legitimate criticism against Israel hunting for the mastermind of last year's attack. That's just like the United States obviously was hunting for Osama bin Laden. I think that the criticism waged against Israel is the broader violence. But the fact that they wanted to catch this guy is not in any way surprising, and I don't think that it's objectionable. This is by definition a mass murderer. However, in my experience, until I saw that video this morning, he was kind of a dehumanized, exactly what you said, like a dehumanized concept out there. Someone who I didn't really have any connection with, just basically like, hey, he's the mastermind behind murdering over 1,000 people, and that's it. And, you know, kind of, I hope that at some point he will be brought to justice. That was my position until this morning. But once you see that video, you see a human being, kind of an eerie, unpleasant video of a human being wounded, knowing that it's his last moments of life, knowing that the end is near. And all of a sudden, you tell yourself a story about that person, right? And even though that doesn't, he doesn't deserve any sympathy in any way, he does become much more human than anything that I had in my mind before. And in that sense, this is also within the context of all that violence and all that human slaughter that has happened over the past year. And as a result, the impact on me, and I'm sure on many others, is not at all what the Israelis would probably like.
I agree. I mean, I don't see a lot of people celebrating this in itself, right? The video, like the news was definitely celebrated, right? I mean, Biden said, oh, great. Obviously, other politicians also said, well, he was a terrible person and now he's dead. So that's good, right? To paraphrase here. Quickly going back to how this was presented by basically the IDF, because there were also two pictures published, right? So there was first a picture of him that was kind of used in speculations to identify him. And that's just a picture of someone who had just died, right, in kind of in the rubble of ruins and a lot of dust in his face. And there was a second picture where a huge chunk of his head is missing. So you clearly see that someone did something to him, and most likely, I mean, I'm not too familiar with all these, with what happens when you shoot a person in the face, but I assume that's what happened. And that kind of tells you more about the individual psychology of the soldiers who were involved, right? That they found him, they found a dead body, he's dead. You could now, I don't know, retrieve him, you could give him to his family, you could leave him there, whatever, he's dead, you have that confirmed. But no, they shoot the corpse one more time, I assume out of revenge. I mean, from the standpoint of his individual psychology, I can understand that young soldier, right? Very young, saw these images. It's right after October 7th now, right? So it's anniversary was just 2 weeks ago. Now a lot of these images will be very present again, so I can understand him. But that tells you so much about, I assume, the overall psychology of the IDF. If every single one of those young soldiers is feeling that way, then I'm not sure whether Israel has kind of maneuvered itself into a healthy psychological state in the last year.
Indeed. And then on top of that, the decision to actually publish those pictures, right? So it's one thing that happens and that this young soldier took a picture of this deed, but then to make that publicly available says something about the psychological state that the IDF is in general, or Israel maybe as a whole. And it's one of those things that rationally, what you want to portray if you're Israel is say, hey, of course we're hunting this guy, obviously. I mean, no question. We want to give the image of an efficient, rational force that just brings justice to this man who murdered so many of our civilians. And by showing these images of unnecessary violence, what you're describing, shooting him twice, and then feeling comfortable publishing that, you're doing the opposite. You're creating an image of a army, a military organization that is not doing things through rational, reasonable analysis, but that is doing things out of an emotional state of mind, out of vengeance. And that is exactly the opposite, because at that moment, you basically put yourself on the same level as Hamas. You put yourself, because that's the argument that Hamas has, right? Like, we are resisting decades and decades of pain and suffering, and therefore we do things that might in normal circumstances not be acceptable. Well, Israel is now basically placing itself exactly there. Like, hey, we have had this enormous trauma and that allows us to be emotional and non-rational actors. And that is a terrible, terrible image for Israel to portray to the rest of the world. On top of that, how much literature has been written? How many stories have been told about how this kind of violence doesn't lead to a better world, right? One thing is to arrest or even kill the leader of a terrorist attack. Okay, fine. But they don't seem to connect anymore to millennia of human wisdom that has told us over and over again that this kind of violence only leads to further violence, that it doesn't stop anywhere, that it's not gonna make you a better, safer society.
Which is the argument that we made last week, is that if Israel was at least achieving its strategic goals and kind of becoming safer as the state, right, and kind of getting rid of, its enemies. But no, if it's actually just kind of creating further violence and really doing the opposite of that, because, I think we can, right, this is one of the easier things to say, that one of Israel's most important strategic benefits, or basically upsides, is that they have the United States in their corner, right? A huge, the biggest military power in the world, who sent them weapons regularly, who sent them money, also assistance, right, in intelligence and in military knowledge. Yet they're currently doing everything in their power to kind of alienate that ally, right? So every single thing they're doing is really going against their own interest. And that is so interesting to observe and also very heartbreaking at the same time. That said, I'm almost at a loss for words.
Yeah, so if you've got the strategic goals, goal number one, bring justice to the victims by getting the killers of the murderers of your victims. So the heads of Hamas, maybe some of the main leadership, you want to catch them just like you want to catch Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda leadership. Okay, that's one strategic goal. Another strategic goal is maybe to reduce the power and influence of Hamas, which is not through killing as many Hamas people as possible, because that just leads to more people joining Hamas in the long term and more hatred and all that. But that would require the creation of alliances, that would be basically undermining the political position of Hamas rather than just going on a murder spree, right? Which is exactly what Israel has been doing this past year. The third is to make sure that you've got broad strategic alliances that are not specifically related to Hamas, but just alliances to make sure that the existence of your state in a very difficult region, in a very difficult environment with a very difficult history, is guaranteed. And so arguably the only thing they are achieving is that first strategic goal. They're catching some of the leaders responsible for the violence of October last year. That's it. The other two are going in the other direction. Not just that they're not achieving the goals, but they're making things worse. And the fact that after a year this continues, and even today Netanyahu announced that the war is going to continue. That's, you know, I loved how Reuters put this in the headline. Netanyahu promises that the war will continue, as if that's something that we want him to promise. Is to me a sign that this is not just a problem of one or two leaders at the top in Israel. It's a whole psychological mindset. It's an emotional state that goes very, very deeply into the Israeli psyche. And it's understandable at some level. I mean, if you look, you can have that conversation about where does that emotional state come from, just like 9/11 for the United States. But it is horribly, horribly destructive for the Israeli people.
Well, particularly because there were voices a year ago that kind of predicted this, including ourselves, right? If you go back to the episodes we recorded exactly 1 year ago, it basically said, oh, one of the worst things Israel could do now is lash out, right? Right now, the state has all the sympathies of the world. And the worst thing it could do right now is lash out and I don't know, start a ground invasion of Gaza. And here we are a year later. One very interesting thing you just did in kind of when you listed those three strategic goals, I assume in your role as a consultant, you immediately did it for the government of Israel and already took into account what they are believing, because one thing you left you left out were the return of the hostages, which I mean, right, there have been debates lately on how far up the list of Netanyahu's priorities that is. But this is a narrative that we see now after the killing of Sinwar, is that the media, like a lot of the media, says, oh, this is a deciding point in the conflict. This is almost a turning point. Maybe we can now get the hostages back. Balder, what's your professional opinion on this?
Well, you're absolutely right for pointing that out, but it's exactly that, right? I think it is fair to state, just based on the evidence from the last year, that getting the hostages back has not been a major goal for the Netanyahu government. Otherwise, they wouldn't have done what they did. None of the actions that they engaged in were actually seriously focused on protecting the hostages. It was, of course, they want them back. I don't think that they want them dead, but it wasn't on their list of priorities. And you're absolutely right. That's why I didn't list it there. And yeah, now so the problem with killing these leaders, you kill or you arrest, but in this case you kill Hamas or Hezbollah leaders because you feel that's an act of justice. It is not an act that will open doors to negotiations. The opposite. It is not an act that will lead to an improved position, strategic position, in relationship to the Palestinian or the Lebanese people. That's not how it works. You do this, and it's a defensible position. You do this because you want to bring justice to the Israeli people. But don't believe for 1 second that now, because of this, all of a sudden Hamas is going to say, hey, let's negotiate. Very much the opposite, obviously.
I concur with that. I mean, well, there's also voices that say, because you mentioned this earlier, that basically every week another commander or general gets killed, that there's currently no one left to make that decision, which is, I don't know, everything I've learned in IR in the past 2 years points to the direction of there's nothing worse than having an organization without leadership, because that means crazy people can quickly rise to the top, or individuals can make decisions because there's no one keeping them in check.
That's exactly it, right? So you've got, there's no doubt in my mind that right now Hezbollah and Hamas are scrambling. It's been a really rough year for them, obviously. It's not easy for an organization to have this kind of destruction. But scrambling and basically trying to deal with the chaos is not the same as dying as an organization, right? And instead of dying, it's very likely that Hamas and Hezbollah in the long term will be empowered by what has happened. In the short term, exactly what you're saying, the consequence, if you look at organizational structures, is when leadership gets killed, and it's not just being killed, but also leadership finds it difficult to communicate with each other, right? Because there is no coordination, because everyone is all the time running from the IDF. What you have is you're going to have the most radical elements taking the upper hand, because they're the ones who are willing to easily sacrifice their own lives or the lives of others. They're going to be the ones in control at a local decentralized level, and they're going to do even more horrible things. On top of that, the recruitment process is going to focus on those who are actively eager for violence. So you now have a identity shift in Hamas and Hezbollah because of this leaderless situation that they're in. That's going to have very significant and negative consequences for Israel down the line.
I'm going to have to make a hard cut here now from the topics, simply because I can't think of a good way from moving from talking about Hamas and Hezbollah to the US elections. Last week, we spoke about the same topics, where first we spoke about Joe Biden, and from there it was easier to go to the Middle East. This week, we just spoke about the Middle East. Let's move on to the US elections, which is obviously a topic that will be on our minds for the next few weeks to come. And there's an individual we are particularly interested in today, and that individual is Elon Musk and his involvement in the Trump campaign. Elon Musk, I don't think I have to introduce him, right? One of the richest people in the world, CEO of Tesla, of X or Twitter, SpaceX. He dabbled in PayPal as well, right? And someone that a few years ago, I remember reading his biography in 2018, I actually had a lot of respect for, because I thought, wow, this is someone who is doing a lot on a lot of different levels, and some of these ideas are actually good. Well, 6 years later, in 2024, we're looking at a different picture of an Elon Musk who has donated $75 million for Donald Trump for the campaign, and is also now actively campaigning for him, because he apparently has been promised the position of lead government efficiency commissioner, whatever that means. Walter, what are your feelings on Musk? Because I remember that a few years ago, you were already critical of him back then.
Yeah, it's fascinating. A lot of questions listening to you rise up in my mind. The first one is, why would he ever want a position in the Trump administration? Just out of curiosity, you know, what is in it for him there? Some kind of ego thing, but I don't think his ego needs more bolstering. It seems very odd to me.
Well, this is what they said about Trump in 2016. I mean, why does Trump's ego need more bolstering? But he then still went for it.
Right, but you could argue that becoming president, I could see Elon Musk wanting to be president of the United States. I mean, he can't because he was born in South Africa, but you could see that desire in Trump or people like that. But, a relatively minor role in the Trump administration, why, if you are Elon Musk, why would you? But okay. Another thing that springs to mind listening to you is what you said is very interesting, right? So that 6 years ago, you had sympathy for him, at least interest in him. You thought, hey, this is an interesting man. You were exactly the target, that the type of young man that has formed this enormous army around Musk, right? Exactly people your age, your gender, or I should say your sex, that kind of know, are interested in the world, and that have read up on him, are the ones who are continuously supporting him on X and on other social media platforms, that kind of feel that they've got this personal connection with him, that think that they're friends because once Elon Musk retweeted some of their messages or something like that. How do you say it, by the way, in today's language? Re-X'd or retweeted? What is that nowadays?
I don't know. Renaming Twitter to X, I just remember that he destroyed basically millions of dollars worth of kind of recognition. So I don't know what it's called to re-X someone, maybe?
Yeah, well, this is the worst marketing decision ever. So what I would argue that has happened with him is that this is a man who clearly has some talent, obviously. He has some talent at spotting good technological ideas, and he goes with it and he invests in it and all that, and that led him to having enormous financial success. But this dynamic of this whole army of people around him, and also sycophants directly in his own circles, essentially boosting his already probably narcissistic ego. Again, I'm not a psychologist. This is not an official diagnosis. This is just common language before people write in saying that you shouldn't diagnose people. But a certain narcissism gets then bolstered by this army of followers, the Darios from 6 years ago, who feel that this is finally a man who speaks their language, etc., etc. And that has done something with his brain. Then on top of that, you could argue that he's in a midlife crisis. It has done something with him that has radicalized him in a way that was 6 or 10 years ago not that obvious, right? I mean, it was there, but it wasn't as clearly pronounced as what you see now. The fact that he spends a lot of his money on the Trump campaign, the fact that he talks about world affairs and himself in a very specific and unpleasant way, is the sign of someone who over the past 10 years has been corrupted by too much success and too much admiration from his own army without anyone actually telling him that he can be wrong as well in his immediate surroundings.
I think you chose the right term there, that he has become radicalized. Because, I mean, he's always been a little bit, right, positively crazy, I would say, kind of reaching for the stars, right? I don't know on a scientific basis how much sense it makes to reach, like to go to Mars. But kind of the fact that he's saying, oh, let's go to Mars, right? I think that in itself can be considered admirable. However, he turned from that, which is about, right, 10 years ago, to today, where he will say things like, and I quote, "I haven't been politically active before. I'm politically active now because I think the future of America and the future of civilization is at stake," end quote. Right, and he's saying this in favor of Trump, kind of saying that if we don't vote for Trump, then the future of the civilization is at stake. So that's someone who has, I would say, lost all relations to reality because, I mean, I already disagree with people who say that if Trump gets voted in again, then the end of civilization is near. But why does he see it this way?
Yeah, no, I think that's important to point out, right? So it's not a matter of you and me being particular Harris fans and saying, hey, this is a matter of life and death. I personally hope that Harris will win. I think she's the more reasonable candidate out of the two. But it's not so much about saying, we prefer Harris, therefore Musk supporting Trump makes him crazy. No, the problem is that the way he frames it doesn't make any sense. How can you look at Trump and say, hey, by voting for Trump, we will save civilization? There is no path, that analytical path, that leads you to that conclusion. You may have sympathy for Trump. You may think that Trump is a better political leader than Harris. I don't really know how to make that case, but you could argue that in some ways. But that is not the same as saying, hey, I've never been political. But now this is such a watershed moment in history that if we don't vote for Trump, then everything is going to collapse. Especially given the first 4 years of the Trump presidency. That seems like an insane statement. And I mean insane as in medically insane. Someone who doesn't understand reality.
Yeah. I mean, it would be interesting to have a medical assessment of Musk, right? Just kind of see in the last few years. I mean, we can only do this from afar and you shouldn't really do that, right? To do psychological assessments of others, particularly not from afar. But I mean, let's do it for the jokes of it, and because we're not psychologists, so I don't think we are breaking any oath. But we're looking at a world where, I mean, 6 years ago, there was no pandemic yet. So definitely, right, the pandemic came, and that's when the crazy started a little bit, right? He already moved away from California towards Texas. And I mean, I think our listeners know our take on pandemic policies, also very critical of that. And then you see other elements kind of coming into play that he used to have a son who is now basically a transgender woman, which has kind of led to him being very obsessed with the culture war and kind of going against any form of transgender policies in that sense, where again, I think our listeners also know that we are a little bit careful, right, with that topic in general, because there's simply a lot of unknown, but kind of going from, oh, 6 years ago I was doing fine, and to kind of where Elon Musk is today, that's a big step, and you can clearly kind of see some dents in the last few years where you, I don't know, I would say a hobby psychologist, as I would call us now, would say, okay, something happened there, and that's how you can explain his behavior nowadays.
Well, and the trans issue is very indicative here in the sense that regardless of what your perspective is on the trans debate, gender debate, all those issues, if the moment it affects your own child, I think it is fair to say that the reasonable position is you deal with that individually with your child. If you have any love, any care for your child, regardless of how you feel about choices they make, right? It is your child. You don't go public and you don't use your enormous platform that you have available to you to now basically disown your child. You know, there are parents who have disowned their children, but you do so privately if you decide to do that. And, you know, it's a very radical, it's a very harsh step. It's not a sign of a loving parent towards a child that they've got an issue with. It is the sign of someone who kind of lost the plot and cannot deal with the reality anymore, that their child goes down a route that they don't approve of. And here I think the international relations aspect comes in, because you can see the toxicity of the environment in which billionaires, very powerful people nowadays, exist, right? So there has always been a problem in international relations with men, typically men, being way too wealthy and way too politically powerful and being able to influence society in negative ways. Or sometimes in positive ways, but often in negative ways, based on their own specific agenda. That is something that is as old as the Roman Empire and before. Crassus, the richest man in probably in human history, caused a lot of damage to the Roman Republic. And that is not in itself something new, but what is new about the 21st century is that those men now are subject to this enormous stream of information, of fans, of people on Twitter, on X, on social media, supporting them or hating them, and their ability to very quickly communicate half-thought-out thoughts to the world about anything that they have some feelings about, right? So in that sense, this problem of billionaires and powerful men already influencing international relations is now becoming worse, because those men are in this difficult, incestuous dynamic with technology, with the world's dynamics, and there's nothing stopping them, certainly not Elon Musk, who owns one of the most important social media platforms, to basically engaging with this toxic environment, leading to radicalization, leading to significant policy changes.
Mm-hmm. And all of this in a very, in a weakened West, right? In a West that isn't sure who it is at the moment. There's a lot of debate going on. It's very torn. And into that environment, you have individuals like him, Trump, Musk, and so on, who are taking advantage of this and have assembled way too much wealth and therefore power, which that's definitely something concerning. And that's something that, I don't know, I might be ignorant here, but you don't really hear from other countries.
No, I think it exists in other countries as well, but not at such an explicit level as what you see in the United States, because the United States is all about that free speech. It's all about also celebrating wealth, right? In other countries, very often, the Elon Musks have to be more careful because they are not necessarily seen as heroes for being billionaires, right? In continental Europe, there are lots of societies where, you know, being a billionaire is kind of seen as something ugly, a little bit like, hey, don't be too proud of it, because it's not really how a society should be functioning. It's like a negative externality of the capitalist system. So we kind of need capitalism, and unfortunately, a billionaire comes out of it. Whereas in the United States, it's, oh, look, this is a brilliant example of our capitalist system, that we've got these billionaires. And that gives them a platform that doesn't exist elsewhere. But again, it is then that connection with these information flows, with the fact, I mean, he has tweeted out on Israel, he has tweeted out on Ukraine, really said very radical things about both conflicts as well, creating a lot of negativity, influencing policymakers again. That ability to just wake up in a bad mood in the morning, if you're Elon Musk, or if you're Bill Gates or anyone, right? And to immediately connect to dynamics that aren't your area of expertise is something that is very concerning and is something new. And we don't really know how that is going to impact the way we organize ourselves, because at least in the past, the Rockefellers, you know, from 150 years ago, they they had to do it in much more indirect, subtle ways by basically influencing newspapers, or it would be indirect. They didn't have this ability to immediately throw out their own perspectives and immediately receive feedback on themselves, right?
Well, this is exactly what I meant with that question, right? I mean, I'm aware and pretty sure that in every country you will have your fair share of very ultra rich people who will do everything they can to influence politics, but in such an explicit way, right, that someone becomes even richer than countries. I mean, not in the United States, but in other countries. And I mean, Elon Musk is a significant economic power we have to deal with. That, to me, and then someone who gets this involved in politics, and not only domestic politics, but also international relations, that to me is something new.
Yeah, and certainly through this direct way. And the fact that you've got this army of supporters that basically create an echo chamber for him, and that creates sort of a good versus evil narrative. Because if you've got, I don't know what it feels like, because obviously I don't have this, but if you, I imagine if you have millions of people admiring you and telling you that they admire you, that does something with your psychology. And then if someone says to you, hey, maybe you should calm down on Ukraine, or maybe you should calm down on Gaza, then you see that person as the enemy, because you've got confirmation from millions of people that you are a hero and that you're right about everything you do. So I think it's that toxic environment that makes it particularly worrisome.
Speaking of seeing people as the enemy and toxic environments, let's move on to the topic of migration in Europe.
That's a good segue, Dario. This time you didn't have to use a hard cut.
I would say so too. We have already expressed our confusion in the past about Germany introducing border checks again, right? So Germany said, this migration thing is getting out of hand. We need to introduce border checks again, effectively kind of undermining Schengen, and also not a really effective tool against any form of migration in this sense. All it did was make basically the neighboring countries of Germany really upset, who said, why are you doing this? I thought we had this agreement here that's called Schengen. And it only took about a month until the next country said, you know what, it's not such a bad idea. Now that the Germans have done it, we can do it too. And that country is France.
And this is, again, part of a bigger picture, I would argue. You see increasingly, besides bad policy being implemented to soothe the emotional state of mind of local populations, because that's all that it is, right? The German government just basically wants to signal to the German population, hey, we understand that you're concerned about immigration and we're doing something about it. That's exactly what France is doing as well, even though it has very little to no practical impact on anything, except that it annoys neighbors. And it costs money, of course. The bigger picture here is that you see, if you want to say it philosophically, from a historical perspective, the ebb and flow of society. Whereas for decades and decades, we moved towards a more, if you like, cosmopolitan world, where it was more about, hey, the big ideas of how can we create a better tomorrow. Now, societies are returning to a sense of national identity and clearly defined nationalism, where being French is more important than being European, where being French is more important than the well-being of the rest of the world. It's about protecting your own island, called France or Germany or the Netherlands or Spain. You want to protect your own tribe, your own identity, and everyone outside of that tribe, whether they come from Germany or whether they come from Sub-Saharan Africa or whether they come from the United States, anyone outside of your own tribe is a potential danger. So basically this othering of almost the whole global population except for your own nationality is a very powerful dynamic at the moment. And it's basically taking us back to the state of mind that people were in 100, 200 years ago, right? When we hadn't gone through this globalization process and this cosmopolitan approach of saying, how can we work together as a globe, because the challenges we face are global, and a human being in France is just as valuable as a human being elsewhere in the world. It is a concerning dynamic that we are going back to this nationalist populist framework.
And very fitting into this is kind of the recent, if I say escalation, right, it sounds so intense, but this recent escalation of tensions between Canada and India in diplomatic means, something that has been going on for a few years now. I mean, I remember every few months, you kind of hear something about, oh, India versus Canada.
I believe it started in the early summer of 2023, the real escalation. There were tensions already, but the real escalation started, I think, May or June 2023.
Yes, exactly. With the killing of I think an Indian national within Canada, which that's kind of how it started. Before that, I remember this in 2018. There was something very funny where Indians were very upset about a dinner that Trudeau basically hosted. And people were very upset about that. So that's kind of when it starts. So I believe that the personal relations between Trudeau and Modi are already not the best, which obviously is only conducive to an environment like this. But so there have been tensions for over a year now. Then trade negotiations were paused, and now you see this kind of escalation on a diplomatic level, where kind of the countries pull diplomats from each other, which is basically the international relations way of saying I unfriend you on Facebook.
Well, and then send some really nasty messages about you to your friends and things like that, right? It's the problem, and you know, on the surface is about the Sikhs, right? There is this Sikh minority, about 25 million people in northern India in the Punjab region, where there are separatist tendencies that goes all the way back to the 1960s, basically Sikhs who want to create their own state. That is a badly defined movement, badly defined in the sense that it's not very clear what that would look like and based on what, but there is this separatist movement. That separatist movement is very much supported by Pakistan, who's trying to undermine Indian stability, and they've been doing that for all these decades. And there is, after India, the largest diaspora of Sikhs lives in Canada. So on the surface, it's basically the Indian government going after Sikhs because they believe that from Canada, they're planning separatist actions, possibly terrorism, etc., etc. At a bigger scale, it is a very concerning sight to behold, because India and Canada used to be the two reasonable actors on the world stage, right? They used to be the Canada, of course, as the reasonable version of the United States, like less militaristic, North American, very similar in culture and outlook, but much more polite, much more reasonable in the way that they engage in international relations. And India, the non-aligned, calm, largest democracy in the world actor that would never choose aggressive sides. Their foreign policy would be very much about holding it all together, trying to be friends with everyone, not to alienate anyone, despite some issues with China. Those are the stereotypical historical images of these two countries. And the fact that exactly those two countries are now fighting at it, they're at it over an issue that is obviously something that you could deal with also diplomatically, is a real sign of the times and where we are going with this. It seems to facilitate the domestic position of Trudeau at home. Hey, I'm standing up for Canadians against evil interference from the outside. And from Modi's perspective, I'm standing up for Hindu nationalism wherever it goes, and I'm not going to be hampered by diplomatic symbolism or anything like that.
We're living in, I don't want to say dark times, because compared to history, right, times aren't really dark, but compared to the last 20 years, it feels darker. And one of the things I haven't heard in a long time is that we're living in the best kind of version of the worlds that we have ever seen on the planet. Is that still true? Like, I feel like in 5 years, I haven't heard anyone made that claim.
No, because statistically, you can't make that claim anymore. GDP, economically, we're the richest the world has ever been. That's the one good thing you could say if you think that GDP is important. But we are statistically not as happy or as doing as well as we were 20 years ago. Certainly, and then when I say we, I'm talking about the West. Because if you look at China, for example, you can make the argument that the Chinese population is close to their peak. even though there are clouds hanging over China with respect to the future, but is close to its peak in terms of welfare levels, the standards of living, etc., etc. In the West, very objectively speaking, 20 years ago, certainly the late 1990s and the early 2000s, the population was happier, better off, healthier. In the United States, the average age of living, the life expectancy has gone down for the first time in a long time. There is greater poverty, there is greater stress, there is more suicide, etc., etc. So you don't hear it anymore because it's simply not true anymore. Now, it is still pretty good in historical terms, right? I mean, living in Western Europe or North America is still much better now than through 99% of its history. But it's no longer the peak. And I think the most concerning thing about this is not so much just the standards of living that are slowly going downhill for large groups of the population. It is that the dynamics are pointing towards a violent tomorrow, right? We are moving towards a tomorrow where internally populations are split and are no longer respecting basic standards, you know, levels of decency. And towards the external world, towards the outsider, the foreigner, we are becoming more and more aggressive and less interested in cooperating with them. So I think the most concerning issue is not the fact that we've gone downhill a tiny little bit, but that the dynamics point at a very scary future ahead of us.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on the current state of the Western bubble. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
It is a quote that I may have at some point already used, you know, in one of our earlier episodes, but it seems so apt to both the issues surrounding Israel as well as the state of the world in general today, and it is by Martin Luther King. And he said, "The ultimate weakness of violence is that it is a descending spiral, begetting the very thing it seeks to destroy. Instead of diminishing evil, it multiplies it. Through violence, you may murder the liar, but you cannot murder the lie, nor establish the truth. Through violence, you murder the hater, but you do not murder hate. In fact, violence merely increases hate. Returning violence for violence multiplies violence, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars."